My name's Peter Riley. I'm actually older than Israel. I was born in 45 before Israel was formed. My father was a civil servant in Palestine. My mother's Palestinian, Lebanese heritage. And my father told my mother that we lived in Haifa. He told my mother that we were going on holiday for 3 months. Otherwise, she'd never have left. So we left all our possessions behind. And just as the British left, a month or so before the British left, we went on holiday to England and we were here permanently. My mother cried for 3 years, when she knew about it and couldn't return. But she told me lots of stories when I was quite young. And then at university in 67, when the Six-Day War started, I gave a lecture to the university students. So I was a student myself. And I read General Glubb's book, Pasha Glubb, who led the Arab army, and he was a scholar from Preston. And as I was reading it, I thought, well, my mother told me this, my mother told me that. And I've taken an interest ever since. So I've been following the news and
Can you just tell us
campaigning.
how your mother and father got to know each other?
Well, my father was originally in the Palestine police, and he was very laid back about curfews, etc. My mother had a brother across the road, and he'd often let her just go across. But my mother told me that he wooed her like Romeo and Juliet. I mean, he was well educated. He was brought up in a priory to become a priest, so he had Latin background, and he picked up and French, and he picked up Arabic quite quickly. And he was had a good command of English language and poetry, and that's how they met. And well, that's all I know. I don't know
Well,
very much
okay,
about it.
so can you tell us what the Palestine police was and what your father was doing?
The Palestine police were the police of Palestine while Palestine was British mandate. And although a lot of the police were quite brutal, actually, obviously I heard a lot of stories about the Palestine police, but I mean, he obviously wasn't. My mother said to him, what are you doing with your education as a policeman? And somehow or another, I'm not sure the story, but he joined the civil service, and within 3 months he was chief inspector of the Ministry of Food. My mother did tell me that he was offered bribes a lot because it was a black market, and he never took bribes, but he would collect the evidence and take it to the courts, where they always dropped the cases on technical grounds. As a matter of interest, my mother's sister was in the Sisters of Charity, and she used to receive money regularly from my father, which was bribe money, which he wouldn't accept. His friends would say, do what you like with it, the case is closed, but he would never keep it. But my mother told me, he said, well, I can always sleep at night. So he's a very, very moral person, extremely moral, had very strong principles.
So,
So
what
that's the
stories
background.
do you have from his? I mean, you've just told us a couple, but you're just generally trying to keep the peace cannot have been easy.
Oh no, of course, because as you probably know, the British allowed almost unlimited immigration until there was a revolt, and the revolt was because the immigrants were not just buying the land under them and dispossessing them; they were also denying them jobs. The Palestinians couldn't get jobs, so obviously they revolted, and the British put down the revolt, but also limited the immigrants, and because they limited the immigration of Jews. The Jewish gangs, the terrorist gangs like Ergun, etc., set against the British. So the British were up against
So
the
what? Sorry, but
Palestinians.
what year was this that the uprising and the
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 uprising, the up the revolt, actually, the Arab revolt was 1936 to 1939. It was in response to the flood of Jewish immigrants and their dispossession of their lands. But apparently, according to Glubb's book too, the Palestinians originally welcomed the Jewish immigrants as almost blood brothers. It was only when they could see the disadvantages, in fact, the fact they were being dispossessed, did they turn against it and start fighting the British to limit the immigration.
Because there's a film out called Palestine 36. I wonder if you've seen it, Peter.
I've not seen it, but I know the story quite well. I've read a lot of books on the history of the period. So yeah, the
I
British were
mean, what it
extremely
does is
brutal.
it portrays the British as brutal, really,
Yeah,
and
indeed.
almost the settlers that were arriving at the time are yes, they're making settlements that, but they're kind of ignored almost by the film.
Well, I don't know, but I know that the British used collective punishment, burned down villages, arrested whole families, etc., just as the Israelis are doing now. I think they learnt it from the British, in fact. So, yeah, it was
So,
to
what
put
did
down
your
the writer.
father, as a supposedly moral person, have to say about all this?
Well, I don't know how long he was in the Palestine police before he met my mother. My mother, as I say, asked why he was doing as a policeman with his intelligence, with his education, etc. And he soon joined the Ministry of Food. So I don't know about that. My father told me very, very little. All I know is about my mother. But when I was quite young, very young, 10, 11, 12 upwards, I would talk to my mother a lot. Now, my brothers and sisters didn't talk about it, although they were older than me. I don't think they talked to my mother as I did, but I took an interest at a very, very early age in not just this, but also other, injustice issues around the world. Quite amazing when I think about it, but I just thought that was normal in those
Okay,
days.
so can you just take us through a bit of the history from the 1930s to up until today? I mean, it's a big question, I know, but things have been going from bad to worse, it seems. Every change is for the worse, it seems, in Palestine since the British left, and possibly people might say since the British arrived.
Well, indeed. Well, because the British couldn't handle both the from both sides being attacked by the Irgun and by the Palestinians, they left it to the United Nations. And in 1947, the United Nations came up with this partition plan, but it gave 54% of the land to the Jewish immigrants, and whose numbers at the time had increased to 30%. I should tell you, first of all, I think it's important for your listeners to know that the Jews lost their majority in Palestine by the 4th century CE. That was partly because, or largely because of conversion to Christianity, the Nazarenes, etc., the followers of Jesus. But 1880s, when Zionism started, there were less than 3% of Palestine were Jews. By the Balfour Declaration in 1917, when British promised a homeland for the Jews, they were still less than 10%. And by 1947, when in fact, after the partition plan, they were still only, about, well, they were still a minority, about a third of the population. So nothing was fair. And Britain had no right to actually. Or even the United Nations had no right to petition it because, under the terms of the mandate, the British had to consult the Palestinian people before any decision was made. As you know, a mandate is for a country to administer a country until and prepare it for independence, but they were supposed to consult the people. Now, the United Nations was General Assembly had no authority to give. To petition Palestine anyway, had absolutely no authority to do so. And in fact, when it went to, they're only an advisory body, the United Nations Security Council could not pass it because it was illegal, because the Palestinians hadn't been consulted. So because the Palestinians obviously rejected it, because it was very, very unfair. I mean, Palestinians own 94% of the land. I mean, Jews only had 6% of the land, the whole of Palestine at the time. So it was incredibly unfair, and you wouldn't expect anyone to accept it. Now, the myth is that when the British left, I think in about a few months or a few, about a month or so before May, the Israelis or the Zionists declared themselves an independent state. That's
So
May the 6th,
this
I
is
think.
1948 we're talking about.
That, yeah, with 48, which was a year after the petition plan. Petition plan was pretty late, I think it was November 1947. Now, the myth is that poor little Israel was attacked by all these Arab countries, and that's what led to the slaughter of the Palestinians. I think 15,000 were killed and 750,000 were exiled permanently. But what they don't tell you is that the plan all along was ethnic cleansing, and the terrorism, if you like, and the slaughters started long before Israel declared war, or sorry, the Arabs attacked the new Jewish state, really to defend the Palestinians. And he actually agreed not to go beyond the borders set by the partition plan. So I should tell you too this, that we've been told lie after lie and lie after lie after, about Israel and Palestine. I've got a book, and you can read it online by, okay, the author was Rabbi Chaim Simons, and his book was called A Historical Survey of Proposals to Remove the Arabs from Palestine, 1897 to 1947. And
Hang
in it,
on, 1897?
yes, or even earlier than that, I think. I haven't got any notes in front of me at all. It may have been 1880s, in fact. But the point is, while the Zionists were saying all we want to do is to live in peace and harmony with the Palestinian Arab population, they were planning ethnic cleansing all along. Now, Rabbi Simons had access to the archives in Hebrew and the IDF archives as well, and he could see their correspondence and their the minutes of the meetings, which proved that they were planning ethnic cleansing. And the military option was called the Dalit plan. And this was first put into
Sorry,
operation.
what, just if you could just clarify, say that again, and how do you spell that?
The Dalit, Dalet. The plan was the military option to ethnically cleanse Palestine from Arabs. And in 1948, it was before the State of Israel, but a month before the State of Israel was formed, they attacked a village called Deir Yassin, which was a peaceful village. It wasn't armed at all, and they slaughtered about three quarters of the population, although those figures are disputed. Now, some Zionist revisionists say, yes, it did take place, because many of them denied it ever happened. They said it did take place, but the ends justified the means. And the figures were exaggerated to scare the Palestinians to leave. And indeed, a number of cities, towns, villages, etc., were raided by the Irgun and other terrorist organizations to clear the villages from Palestinians. So the dispossession started long before, months before the State of Israel was declared. So that's really the background. And the figures between 750,000 and 850,000 fled, and they've got no right to return, in spite of the fact that it's a legal obligation. Under international law, refugees do have a right to return. Many of them have taken their keys and their deeds with them. Now, in the next following years, 500 villages were razed to the ground, and many more people were massacred. Some of these villages were covered in forests, so they could not rebuild again. Few others became sort of Israeli settlements, Israeli towns, in other words.
Yeah, just to say, Deir Yassin is West Jerusalem.
Yes, that's
And I
right. Yes.
wonder, just give us the name of this plan again, because it does seem as if all of the promises that were made in the Balfour Declaration and at the United Nations in 1948, etc., were just a cover, potentially.
Well, most of, yes, exactly,
What was
absolutely
the name of the
exactly.
plan again, please, Peter?
Dalet, Dalet. I think that's a Hebrew word for the D plan. You find this in Ilan Pappe's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan Pappe was a historian, history teacher at Haifa University. He's now teaches at Exeter University, and can't be so far away from you. And he's regarded as one of the modern revisionists, but he's one of the most authoritative historians on Palestine because, of course, he has access to the archives.
Yeah, well, look, I think I'd like to hear a bit more, if you don't mind, from your mum, because it sounds to me as if she was one of those people who was observing all this going on and telling young Peter all about it.
Exactly, yes. I can tell you some other things which also debunks the myths. I mean, the myth is that Arabs and Jews, Muslims and Jews, etc., have never got on together. Well, Arab, Christian, and Muslims got on very well together until the immigration of the European Jews into Palestine. My mother told me her Jewish friend said that she resented the immigration of European Jews because they tried to set them against their own neighbors and their friends, and of course they had a different culture. And she also told me that the early Zionists placed bombs in the marketplaces, Arab marketplaces, not so much as to get to the Arabs, but as a warning to the Jewish people not to support Arab markets, to boycott Arab markets, in other words. And she did tell me a story about a girl in an office where she worked, an immigrant Jewess, who packed up her Australian boyfriend because he refused to boycott Arab shops and markets. So, that's a myth which has been destroyed now, that the fact that they never lived in peace and harmony. Actually, one of my uncles married a Jewess. I'm not sure whether she was a European descent or indigenous Jew, but Jews and it's not a Jewish and Muslim and Christian thing. It's a Zionist thing. That Zionism is the wicked thing. Incidentally, the policy of separating themselves from the Arabs and their friends, etc., became official in 1925. I only read this recently. I've given some talks on this, some presentations to various groups, and I didn't realize until I did a bit of research, it sort of came up that this became official policy, that they were to separate themselves from the Arabs, have nothing to do with their friends and their neighbors.
Yes, well, apparently the Zionists are very worried that they might now be boycotted. I wonder if you could take us through some of the. I mean, you mentioned right at the start the 6 Day War in 1967. Then there was Yom Kippur in
Yes.
1973, I think it
Oh.
was. But there have been these various military conflicts with the United States getting involved for whatever reason. And in fact, sometimes I think it was Yom Kippur, there was actually a threat to use nuclear weapons by the Israelis, and the Americans said, oh, okay, well, we'll send you some conventional weapons to help. So this is all sorts of shenanigans that have been going on since the beginning of the troubles, the Nakba in 1948, and since then, so up till today.
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, because in 1967, when the 6 Day War started, I was at university. I had a Jewish friend, he was my best friend, in fact, who was so worried that Israel was under existential threat. He believed all the rhetoric. I knew a little bit different. That's why I started doing research and gave a talk to the group. But since then, I've read a book by Mikko Peled, and it's called The General's Son. And he said that his grandfather was a founder, one of the founders of the Zionism. He was a signatory to the independence document, and his father was a general in both the 48 war and the 67 war. And he said his father told him that he was present at the decision making. And although all the mythology was poor little Israel was being attacked, I mean, we were told then at the time they were attacked by the Arabs. We obviously could find out easily enough through aerial photographs that the Israelis attacked them. But then they said it's an extension, they were under existential threat. And it's the story which they hold still today, and most people believe. But the general's son had said his father stated they knew that the Arabs were not ready for war for at least 2 years, but this was a good opportunity to attack them. Now, the Ilan Pepe, in his book on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, also stated there were two times when the Israelis were going to attack the West Bank, because although they accepted the partition plan and the division of Palestine, they thought that only temporary, and they were preparing for to take the rest for a long time. But Ben Gurion, the prime minister, said the world wasn't ready to receive it. Public opinion would be against us. And so it was postponed. But because Israel developed the nuclear bomb, or certainly a Dimona, it's alleged that they developed it in 1956 or something like that. The Arab armies were expected to be attacked, and they actually moved to the borders. Also, according to Ilan Pepe, The Arabs were being provoked all the time, particularly in Syria. A lot of the water was being redirected to Israel. It was very provocative. They were trying to get a war, but the Arabs were expecting a war, and they lined up on the border. Now, this is the reason they say that Israel attacked, because they were expecting to be attacked. It was a preemptive strike. So that was narrative which was a myth, and in fact it's been debunked, although it's repeated again and again. And of course, in 67, they took over the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza area. I should say that there were no settlers in the West Bank in 1967. There are now over 700,000, possibly nearly 800,000 settlers in it. And they've obtained those settlements by dispossessing Palestinians, burning their crops, slashing them with chainsaws, destroying their houses, shooting them, taking their sheep, etc. And the stories are horrific, and they're going on right to this day. And when the Palestinians try to protect themselves, they indeed are arrested. There's not been any settlers, as far as I know, who've been arrested and are in prison for their crimes against humanity and against the Palestinians. I mean, it's getting so bad now, some of the Israelis, older Israelis, are worried about it and said it's got to be controlled, because we're really worried about public opinion. As the world gets to know what's going on right now, and they realize that what the Israelis are doing is not because of Hamas attacking them. There's no Hamas in the West Bank. It's their plan is to take over the country, as to make it a Jewish state and an exclusively Jewish state. And of course, they're not going to settle in Palestine. They're already creating settlements in Lebanon. They've been attacking Syria and Lebanon on a daily basis now, which we don't hear about on the news. But their plan was from the Nile to the Euphrates, which included parts of Lebanon in the Greater Israel. And although people said, oh, this was a myth, because it was revealed in a book, in an article in the published by the World Zionist Federation. It was an article by Odin Yinon, who stated it's about a plan for Greater Israel, and said they couldn't beat the Arab nations. What they've got to do is to get them to fight each other. And there was a chapter on each of the countries which in fact have now been, attacked. It's divide and conquer. Stir up trouble, fight them, weaken them, and then you can take over.
So why do you think the British and the world community have been so supportive? I mean, not the whole world, obviously, but basically the NATO countries, the West, Europe, etc., have been so supportive of Israel during this recent genocide to be so really making things easy. I mean, for example, proscribing the Non-Violent Direct Action Group that's trying to stop the war crimes in the UK, and also allowing arms sales to Israel, and financial support to Israeli companies during a genocide.
Yeah, and indeed, actually providing surveillance for the Israelis to pinpoint the targets. Well, the reason can only there can only be one reason, can only be one answer, and it's the power of the Zionist lobby. They throw money at politicians, particularly in the United States and in Britain. The Zionist lobby is so powerful, and what I learned through my research is that they had a lot of power in 1914. Weizmann was the became the president of Israel. He was a scientist who developed a something which was necessary for the bomb, cordite, I think it was. He could produce it chemically, which really, without it, we might have lost the war. And Lloyd George said to him, what do we owe you? How much gold do you want? He said, give me Palestine. Now, he had a lot of influence because he was quite influential within the Admiralty because of his scientific work. So he had access to, senior politicians, and he also had a great charisma, etc. He was a very persuasive, charming man as well. But his dream was Palestine, and he persuaded Lloyd George and Balfour to write this declaration on the grounds, on several grounds. One, it said it was the interest of the British Empire to protect, the Suez Canal, etc., and it was necessary to get the support of the Jews, but also. He said it was a way of ensuring, A, the Russians would stay in the First World War, because obviously under the communist regime they left, and many of the communists were in fact Jewish. Now that was verified in a book called Palestinian Papers, 1917 to 1922. Seeds of Conflict by Doreen Egrams. I've read that book. I must have had it 20 years or so now, but I keep popping into it. But it verifies that fact that more or less stating that we get the side of the Jews in Russia, but also in America. Now, in America, you probably know Wilson's was the son of a Presbyterian clergyman who believed in this view that the Messiah will come again once the Jews have returned to Palestine. So he was naturally a Zionist in that kind of sense. But he was also persuaded that it'd be the interests of the Americans if, in fact, the Balfour Declaration was formed because they'd get the Jewish vote. Obviously, he was after the Jewish vote as well, and the Jewish lobby was absolutely enormous. But he was told that the Germans might have their own kind of Balfour Declaration for the Jews, and it's better for us to be get in there first to say we support a Jewish state. So, that's a background. They had a lot of influence from very early days, and they've got phenomenal influence now. You're probably aware that Epstein was probably a Mossad agent. If not a Mossad agent, he was an asset to Mossad, and providing these honey traps for influential people, political leaders, particularly
Well,
when
look,
they put their
Peter,
money
I
in there.
wonder if I can ask you a bit about that, because Ghislaine Maxwell clearly seems to have been in charge. If you watch the documentary Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell, which came out in 2021, it's pretty clear that he was almost came from nowhere, was recruited by her when she went over to New York after the death of her father to create this operation in New York and Palm Beach, and obviously they got their little island too. Money seemed to just appear out of nowhere for them. And so what do you think the purpose and the links of all that is? Because there are also questions about the death of Robert Maxwell back in 1991. He was the media tycoon, really, boss of Mirror Group newspapers. Maxwell had disappeared on an impromptu holiday to the Canary Islands and then was found dead floating in the water. The problem was that he had been filching money from his Mirror Group pension fund to pay his debts for the Mirror Group. And so the whole thing was a big financial disaster. What Sy Hirsch and others have said over the years is that he had gone to the Mossad, who had surfaced in a submarine at the Canaries, and he was trying to negotiate with them, saying, "Look, I need about £500,000 to get my business back on the road again. And if you don't give me that £500 million, then I will print in my newspapers all about my relationship with the Mossad and with Israel." At which point he fell into the sea, had a heart attack allegedly, and drowned. So Ghislaine Maxwell comes out of this relationship. So I wonder what you make of that, of the Maxwell family.
Well, I've heard more or less the same. Well, right from the beginning, there were some suspicions about that, and apparently he was buried in Israel. There's no doubt about his
Well, he had a
connection to
big
Israel.
state funeral in Israel.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. I think it's the same with Epstein. I mean, the way that Mossad operate is through blackmail, through bribes, and through assassinations. And they're extremely successful. That's why politicians are frightened of them, really. But it's worked in a sense because obviously the Israelis have got a lot, Netanyahu's got a lot on President Trump. And to my mind, my interpretation is that Trump has got to do Israel's bidding. Otherwise, they might reveal some of the secrets which would bring him down. I'm not the only one who says this. It's quite a few people saying that. But incidentally, I don't know if you've heard of Jeffrey Sachs was an advisor to 20 different governments. He's got inside information. He's got inside connections, and he's Jewish, of course. And he himself has said that virtually all the wars in the Middle East have been instigated by Israel. America is, in fact, is doing whatever Israel wants to do, and they dare not do it. But even Netanyahu, after the Oslo Accords, he talked to some settlers who were rather concerned that Israel was giving too much away. And he's got a video of there's a video of it, which I've got on record somewhere, where he said, "Don't worry about that. The Americans will do what we want them to do." And once I got the division of Palestine to three areas, and we got 60% as a military thing, we've won. There could never be a Palestinian state. So they've got power and control over the Americans. They more or less almost mock Americans for being so weak. When he's on record amongst his own people saying such a thing.
Well, look, there's another aspect to all of this, and that you did touch on briefly is nuclear weapons. How did the Israelis get nuclear weapons, and are they safe in Israel's hands?
Well, definitely not safe, because Israel has said that if anyone attacks them, they bring the world down around them. The Samson option, they say. I don't know the details. I did read the details, but I forget the details of how it acquired it. But I know they stole a lot of the information, the technology, etc. But they got cooperation as well. But since then, was it Pollard or something, an American who was arrested for treason? He was giving away American secrets on technology, nuclear technology, and other things for many years. But eventually he was released, and he's having a whale of a time in Israel now, and I think he's going to stand for the Knesset. But he served
Well,
a long sentence in America. So you've got insiders giving information to Israel. But I'm very really worried. I have sleepless nights, in fact, worrying about this, because the Israelis can provoke wars, but they get Americans to fight them on their behalf. When I chaired Liverpool Friends of Palestine, I did the website, and I had a whole section on the power of Zionists. And in it, I put a cartoon which said, "Join the American army and fight for Israel." Well, I was marginalized as a result of that. They say, "Well, no, Israel's America's aircraft carrier. It's not the other way around." Well, today I say they're the same, because we know the administration in America are controlled by Zionists. It's no
look, I mean,
secret.
this is a big claim to make, Peter. Can you evidence that Israel really is pulling the strings and America is not the colonialist power that many people think it is?
Well, Jeffrey Sachs says so, and there are many others that say so. I think General, name's forgotten now. Watch his podcast. He's more or less the same. But the evidence is there. If you look at the money going to the politicians, you can see it. I mean, I was teaching A-level politics many years ago. I've been retired over 20 years, but I had something from the week. In the middle of it, they've got issues of the day or whatever, and it was about the Zionist lobby, and it did state that if politicians were supportive of Israel, they immediately got a lot of funding. If they criticize Israel, they not only lost that funding, but it went to an opposition to somebody who did support Israel. I mean, that was over 20 years ago when I
Yeah.
read that. I've
Well,
still got the
look,
article
we've
somewhere.
talked here about Israel and the United States. What about Britain's role in this?
Well, again, you probably know, I just saw a video recently when Jeremy Corbyn was asked, would he support Israel if they were attacking other countries, you know? And he said, "No, I wouldn't." And I think that was what ended his career. And if we start following what's going on now with Mandelson, etc., we could see the Israeli connections very, very strong. So, I mean, Starmer
So, what is
himself.
the Israeli connection to Mandelson?
Well, Mandelson, apart from being Jewish, because it's got nothing to do with being Jewish, but he's got connections with Mossad and the Israeli government. He's visited there lots of times. And Starmer's advisor, whose name I've forgotten, we never heard of him until just recently. He was definitely the mastermind behind Starmer's getting to victory. And indeed, it was
You're
reasonable.
talking about Morgan McSweeney.
McSweeney, yes. And he's an ardent Zionist, or well, he realized that's the way to get power. So he was extremely influential. And Starmer, who is in fact married to a Jewess, I think he's got property in Israel, and he actually goes to the synagogue, and he talks a lot with the board of deputies, etc. There's no doubt that he's a very ardent Zionist, and he's says so unashamedly. You know, he actually said it. He justified the murder of Palestinian children or starving them, in the name of
Even
Israel's
though
right
he's
to
supposed
defend
to be
itself.
a human rights lawyer, yeah. So
Yeah.
you mentioned this idea of almost a religious or heretical religious idea that by the Jews returning to Palestine, this would bring back the Messiah. Can you just talk a bit about that? That sounds like a, if someone gets that sort of idea into their head, then it seems to me they think that any amount of killing of non-Jews is okay.
Well, exactly. In fact, there are probably seven times as many Christian Zionists as Jewish Zionists in America, and they're influenced by a book of the study Bible by Schofield. I think his name is Schofield. Schofield was given the task by his Zionist masters to actually interpret the Bible, and he uses the King James's version, but his interpretation is. He writes in footnotes, and those footnotes are almost as long as the script itself. And people like the Christian bishop, what's his name? Sizer, was his name? Sizer, I can't remember. He's written quite a lot about
Stephen
this.
Sizer, yeah,
Sizer,
he
Stephen
Stephen
Sizer.
Sizer was a vicar, yeah,
That's right.
in
Oh, well,
Southwest
he's,
London.
yeah, well, he's written a lot about it. So that's the best way to find
Yeah,
out is.
Roadmap to Armageddon is his book, Christian
Yeah.
Zionism, Roadmap to Armageddon.
Yes. But that's the reason why Christian Zionists they exist. To me, it's a contradiction. You can't be a Christian and a Zionist. I mean, Zionism is all to do with racism and superiority, whereas Christianity is forgiving your neighbor, loving your neighbor as yourself, turning your other cheek. It couldn't be any more different. Yet they claim to be Christians while they're supporting Zionism in a very big way. I mean, I watched a program many, perhaps decades ago. When in fact, one of these evangelical Christians was raising money for Israel, saying $1 million for settlements, $1 million to our education program for Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the Israelis don't respect them, they're using them. It's very convenient for them to actually get the support of the Christians. But in practice, as you'll see from many recent videos, the Christians are hated in Israel. The Christian population in Palestine has fallen enormously.
Well, what evidence have you got for that?
Well, the statistics themselves show that, but there are visuals, if you like, there are videos taken by Israelis themselves, but also by peace workers, where the Israelis were spit on the Christians. They'd actually attack them and say, "You're not welcome here." There are plenty of videos. There's loads of video evidence if people just looked. In fact, it jumps at me all the
So,
time. I think
what do you think is at the heart of this idea of Christian Zionism then? And what's it really all about? Because it seems to have got taken root in the minds of quite a lot of people.
indeed, particularly in America. I don't think so many in this country have taken up with it. But there are Christian Zionists here, of course. But I went to like a Christmas evening party with a friend of mine who used to be a Catholic. He said he was a born again Christian, and I was talking about Palestine, etc. And they say, "Why are you concerned about Palestine? You should be thinking of saving your own soul." And I said, "Well, surely that's being selfish. How do I save my soul?" He said, "Saying, read the Bible and pray." I said, "Well, I was taught as a Christian that you love your neighbor as yourself. And if there's injustice, you've got to speak up against injustice as Jesus did in the temple." So there are Christian Zionists here in this country, but they're a minority.
That sounds like an interesting argument that you've got to ignore everybody else's plight and just think about yourself to be a Christian.
I know, indeed. It's a contradiction, if you ask me. You know, I said it being selfish, isn't it? Just trying to save my own soul and not bother about anybody else. I mean, the essence of Christianity is being empathetic, loving your neighbor as yourself, don't do it to others that you wouldn't do to yourself, etc. I was brought up a Christian, very strong Christian. My mother's family was very strong Christian, so was my father. He was actually brought up to, was educated to be a priest, but he ran away. He didn't want to be a priest. He had an Irish father. The Irish love to have a member of their family. In the church, Catholic Church, one way or another, but it wasn't from the father.
No.
So
Well, look, what
they
about
were
your
religious.
mum's, what about your mum's faith? That sounds interesting that she had a quite a strong Christian faith coming from Palestine. What was the difference between maybe between that and what you see as Christianity here in
Well,
England?
Well, she was a Christian. She was a Greek Catholic. I didn't even know they existed before then, and most people don't know. Not Greek Orthodox, Greek Catholic. They recognized the Roman Rite, but they were much stricter. So, I mean, I don't know very much more about it. I know that when we were at home, we were quite religious. We always went to Mass on a Sunday. My father, in the days of Latin, he would have all the children at the front saying the prayers in English because they didn't understand the Latin, obviously. He took Latin classes as well because we had to learn Latin to serve on the altar. And we actually, on a Friday night, said the rosary together in the family. I mean, we were very religious.
Yeah,
And
it does
Christmas
sound
and Easter.
interesting. You know, the culture of Palestinian Christianity. You know, what about sort of day to day? How did it affect your family life, do you think?
I have no idea. I wasn't even three. I was 2 and a half when I came to
Well, what
England.
you picked up from your mum?
She didn't really discuss any of that. I mean, she told me she actually loved the British, by the way. She thought the British were marvelous. Although she told me all these other stories, and she told me a lot about the Zionists, how
What,
they,
burning down villages?
well, won all of them like that. Perhaps they probably never got that news. All she knew was the British invested a lot in Haifa in Palestine and built the economy. Indeed, they did. No one can deny that. But it was for a purpose, obviously. They had an ulterior motive. But they were well organized, etc. She told me a lot of little stories about the British. But she also told me about the Zionists, how they hung to British, was it police or those sergeants or something. She told me about the massacre. She told me about people being blown up by IEDs, you know, British troops being and British Palestine police being blown up by the Irgun, etc. So I got these little stories, but I was very young at the time. And they went in, but they're more important to me now, looking back, when I read official histories and see the strong links between what she said and what actually happened. She's obviously a very clever woman. A lot of my family are in Lebanon, in Beirut, and they're still very strong Christians. So I can see that. They're extremely strong Christians.
Well,
I
look,
can see
what about, let's go
Christians.
back to look briefly at this whole nuclear question. You were saying that you think that the Israelis were getting nuclear weapons in the 1950s, so that would be pretty much in parallel with the British. I remember Winston Churchill in the 50s announced to a big surprise, and no one was quite sure where he'd got the money from, that Britain had got nuclear weapons. So what evidence is there that the Israelis had them back in the 50s?
Well, it wasn't in the 50s, wasn't in the 60s. Dimona was the headquarters for the nuclear industry, still is.
Well, yeah, Dimona was founded in 1956.
Was it? Sorry, I've got it wrong. I thought it was near as the seven. I thought it was in
They
the 60s.
may not
Okay.
have actually had the nuclear weapons. They were certainly planning to in the mid-1950s.
Yeah, I'd have to pass on that. I do know. I've got a rough idea in my mind, but I don't want to say anything unless I've not got it accurate. But it certainly they got the materials through devious methods.
The thing is, the reason I ask you, Peter, is because I've been looking at all this material coming out of Massachusetts. This guy, Dr. Todd Ryder, and his research, which goes to show very, very, very strong evidence now from archives and from newspaper articles from 1945 that much of the nuclear material. That the including the three bombs that the Americans had in 1945 was actually developed by the Nazis during World War II. And this brings me back to ask this question now, because finally, really, and this is a biggie, because the comparisons to the Nazis from the Zionist state as it is right now are apparently banned, completely banned under the international recognition of anti-Semitic definition of anti-Semitism, that if you even think of comparing Israeli activities now, the Zionist state in Israel, to the Nazis, then you are apparently an anti-Semite. Can you say whether you think it's justified to compare the present far-right bloc running Israel to the Nazis or not?
What's wrong with making comparisons? Your comparisons might be negative or positive, but don't forget, right from the word go, there were agreements between the Nazis and the Zionists, because they're both racist. They both believe in racial superiority. They both wanted their own land for themselves. And in fact, the Germans allowed the Jews to go to Palestine and take their money, provided they spent that money on German exports. Now, don't forget that after World War I, there were reparations against the Germans, and we had trade blocks against them. You couldn't buy anything from Germany. So they needed money desperately, obviously, and they needed export revenue. And they had this agreement that the rich Jews could go to Palestine, provided, and take their money, provided they spent it. I think it had to be deposited in a special bank, but to be spent on German exports. So even then, there was cooperation between them. But you just have to look at what the Nazis did and what the Zionists are doing now, and form your own opinion. I mean, I can't see how it can be possibly anti-Semitic to make comparisons,
Well,
if in fact they're based on evidence.
this begs the question as to whether Zionism is actually Jewish at all.
Well, I suppose there is a sect of Jews who say it isn't. In fact, they say it's heretical to actually for Jews to return to Israel until the Messiah comes. I can't remember what they are called. I've
Yes, a
heard a couple.
Neturi Carta.
Yes. And of course, originally, most Jews were against Zionism, the whole idea of Zionism, because they thought that it would set them, whether it would, they took a long time to be recognized as British or French or whatever. But if there was a state of Israel, they'd be regarded as foreigners, and that would be to their detriment. That's why in the Balfour Declaration, the third bit is, the second bit was, as long as the rights of the indigenous population is protected, but also as long as the rights of Jews living abroad are protected as well. So, because they really feared that they'd be regarded as foreigners once Israel was formed. I mean, it didn't come about, obviously. But obviously, majority, it seems, of the extremists are in fact are Zionists. And if you look at, right, there's a group of Jews called Chabad Lubavitch. I'll probably pronounce that incorrectly, but they've got a presence in every country in the world, I think. They're at most universities in this country. And they, if you read their writings from their own material, they would say the Jews have got a divine soul and others have only got animal souls. And non-Jews, the Goy, are there to serve the Jews. I mean, it is so extreme. Now, I've got a friend called Nahida Yassin, who was in fact a refugee. Her family was twice made a refugee from Palestine. She's an intellectual and she's done a lot of research into this very question. Where does all this Zionism and come from, and all this racism come from, and this superiority come from? And it comes from the Talmud and writings of the rabbis. Now, you probably know that the Talmud are really just the opinions of rabbis, but somehow they're all inspired by God, and although they're contradictory, they're all true at the same time.
Yeah, basically, it's a bit like if you imagine in the Christian church, it might be books written by bishops or whatever over the years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it's quite dangerous what you see. In fact, I was asked to do a website just on all this ideology, and quite honestly, I'm frightened too, because if I did, it's so damning of them. It seems racism, and people wouldn't want me to talk to them even. You know, you can they can't. They're not ready for such information. So I've not gone ahead with it, but it's all there, and it's in black and white, the Hebrew and the interpretation next to it. So to me, that's the base of the extreme Zionism. This is why the settlers are so extreme. They're quite happy to burn down and torture and rape the Palestinians, take their homes, because they think God's given them that right. In fact, there's a video of one person when there was resistance to him taking the home. He said, "If I don't take it, somebody else will. So what?" And that's
Well,
how bad it is.
I mean, it all rather does sound like this Nazi idea of the master race, getting into people's heads that you are nothing, you are Untermensch, you are an animal, and we are in charge. So it doesn't matter if I kill you, you've just got to leave. Or, this racial superiority, or maybe it's a sort of a form of very dark spiritual superiority. Anyway, look, Peter, what about where people can find your work? And also, you could maybe recommend some sources for our listeners to get good information, because so th th there is a very strong Zionist influence, it seems, in the mass media, which has been helping cover up some of these genocide crimes. Some of it, of course, has been exposed too, which is good to see. But where's the best place to look for to find your stuff? And also, good, what, if you could recommend us a few news sites for getting good information.
Well, yes, with regard to books, Ilan Pappe is the easiest one to read. Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pappe. He's written another book called 10 Myths About Israel. And in it, he states that the 10 major narratives are all myths that are put about. They've been debunked, but not commonly known that they've been debunked. The other book I read, which was very influential, was Mikko Peled, Peled, called The General Son. He's done a number of little podcasts and lectures around America and around the world, in fact, explaining the situation. Don't forget, he was a Zionist. He grew up as a strong Zionist family, but he saw the light. I think one of his nieces was killed by a Palestinian terrorist. And instead of thinking, right, we're going to get our own back, he said, why are they doing this? And started investigating. So he could see the Palestinian perspective. So his book's very good. A third one, which you can get online, is the one I mentioned before by Chaim Haim, it was Chaim Simons, called The A Historical Survey of Proposals to Remove the Arabs from Palestine 1888 or something like that to 1947. For historical information, there is Palestine Remembered is extremely good. It's got so much information there. It's like an encyclopedia with loads and loads of evidence. You can click on any topic and it will explain everything and give you links to even more detail.
Okay, well, Peter, finally, what can we do? Is there any solution to this?
Well, I think once people become more aware, they will put public pressure on the governments to change. The governments have got to respond to their electorate ultimately, but they play on ignorance and the fact that the mainstream media is so pro-Zionist, pro-Israel, so pro-big business that they're not getting the picture. And they're almost, it's like beer and circuses. They're distracted by, pop culture rather than wanting to, read the history. So, but I found that if I told you what I've just said, people would have cut me off, not wanted to know, because they thought I must be anti-Semitic for saying this, in spite of the fact I've got Jewish relatives and friends.
Well,
But
I'm
giving
not
it.
so sure that would be the case, since the genocide. I think many people are horrified and disgusted by the way that the Israeli army and air force, etc., has been used against civilians and caused tens of thousands of innocent people to be killed by armies. I mean, this is really. It's not a war, it's been a massacre. So I think many people can see that around the world, not just here in the UK, and are changing their views about anti-Semitism.
Yes.
And also, anyway, so Peter, what about following you? How can people find you? Are you on social media, etc.?
I started a group called Palestinian Lives Matter on Facebook. There are now something like 97,000 members. I've got my own Facebook, Peter Riley. It's got Southport, or in fact, this might say Lancaster University underneath it. I'm posting several every day. But what I try to do is to join a number of other groups. I'm on about 170 different Facebook groups, and I post to either Christian groups or socialist groups, left-wing groups, Green Party groups, many as I can, just to spread the word. But giving bits of information which are factual, and then gradually they come to realize themselves. The power of the Zionists and the evil of their whole ideology.
Okay, Peter Riley, thanks very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.